So good afternoon to everybody. Before starting, I would like to thank Barbara and Jan for the kind invitation to this interesting meeting. In the next half an hour, I will try to be in time. I will try to convince you that the combination of natural data at global scale about subduction zones, together with the results coming out from analog modeling, can give insights, interesting insights, on the main character of this meeting, the subduction thrust fault. The presentation is structured in four parts. After a brief introduction, I will show you in details the kind of tools we adopted at the laboratory experimental tectonics in the last years in order to study the subduction and the subduction seismicity. And in this way, I will condense in a nutshell the kind of results I obtained working together with a large number of colleagues and friends. And we will end up with looking at possible future directions of these two kind of methodology. But let's start. The subduction process is the engine of plate tectonics, and it's the location where a wide variety of both physical and chemical processes are occurring. It's there that the largest and the most dangerous events are occurring along the subduction thrust fault, the interaction between the interface between the subducting and the wearing plate, when condition of strong locking and strain accumulation build-ups between the plate. We saw during these 2 days that a lot of different things are known about the behavior of the subduction thrust fault, but it's still unclear what can produce the large diversity between the behavior of this structure along the global subduction zones. As you can see from this map, which is plotting the maximum magnitude as given by the GEM catalog, some subduction zones produce great earthquakes and other only a minor activity. But indeed, there is a caveat here because we are looking at a very short instrumental seismic record as respect to the timing of the seismic cycle occurring at the subduction thrust fault. The subduction thrust fault are lacking of direct observables, and all the information we get from the seismicity happened in the past can lack in resolution and completeness. So in which way can we answer to the question about which are the ingredients controlling the interplate seismicity? Well, we need to keep in mind that the subduction process is a process operating over a wide range of spatial and temporal scales. So for sure, we need to think about the fact that we need to understand better what is happening at long-term, large scale, so trying to unravel the behavior of the subduction zones, and afterwards looking at short-term, small scale, and try to define the behavior of the subduction thrust fault, analyzing if and how the parameter space of the long-term subduction process can affect the interplate activity. And for this purpose, it's very, very important to have a multidisciplinary approach, so try to combine together results coming out from different disciplines, because only in this way we can avoid to be like one of the blind men touching the elephant, as described in the John Sachs poem. All of them were touching the elephant without really understanding what was below the hand. And in our small lab, we tried to use this multidisciplinary and multi-scale approach in the last years, working at two different sites, collecting data on global scale, on convergent margins, and trying to statistically analyze them, and then doing modeling. Laboratory models always combined together with numerical ones. And for as far as the long-term, large-scale subduction process is concerned, We have a long tradition in realizing subduction models in the lab, trying to understand the possible links between the geometry, the kinematics, and the dynamics of the process. And we started years ago with very simple configuration, and year after years we were adding complexities in order to understand better the possible cause-effect relationship. As I told you before, we are always trying to combine together the experimental results with, for sure, with results coming from nature and with numerical models. But today there is no time to talk about it, and I will concentrate my attention on something a little bit more new, what we did in the last years to study the subduction thrust fault. And I start showing you the database on current subduction zones. In particular, the idea to correlate the physical parameters of the subduction zones with their seismicity is not really new. The ancestral idea is coming out from Ueda and Kanamori, who in the 1979 were distinguishing the subduction zones in two large categories, the Chilean type and the Mariana type. And both of them characterized by completely different features. And in this frame, in the Chilean type, the rapid subduction of the young and, in turn, buoyant lithosphere was producing a strong coupling between the plate and, in turn, was enhancing the occurrence of great thrust events. On the contrary, in the Mariana type of subduction, an old subducting lithosphere was producing a weak coupling between the plates and was inhibiting the occurrence of great thrust events. Seismic variability of the subduction thrust fault seismicity was thus explained as due to the combination between two main parameters, the age of the lithosphere subducting at the trench and the convergence rate. And this idea was working quite well until new and more updated data were included in the database, showing that the history of earthquakes was really too short to draw conclusion about their long-term distribution. Was tempting for us 25 years later to try to realize a new, reviewed, and updated database, improved both in the accuracy and the homogeneity of the data sources. And we started from the wonderful database originally created by Urella Lehmann in 2005, including kinematic, geometric, and physical parameters of subduction zones, and working with them. First of all, we added new items, for instance, the amount of sediments at the trench, the eruptive rate of active arc, the accretionary erosive crater margin. But what was extremely important for us was also to add information about interplate subduction earthquakes. So combined together the data coming out from different seismic catalogs, we were able to extract along 505 transects sampling the subduction zones with an interval of 1 degree, all these events that are specifically the ones occurring along the subduction thrust fault. And all the information of this database, everything has been already published, is included in a platform hosted by the University of Montpellier, which is a very nice tool that I hope that you can use in the future for your research and your teaching. And what we are doing with this database is to realize statistical analysis on the entire set of the parameters. I will show you something later. But we use also the database as input parameters for laboratory and numerical models and to test afterwards the modeling predictions. Let's move now on analog models, my word. What is an analog model? An analog model, as any model, is nothing else than an attempt to reproduce a natural process at different scales, the spatial and the temporal one. You see here one example, a mountain, a structure that is extending kilometers in nature and structuring is occurring in million years. Well, we can create our sand lab mountain, which is a smaller and a faster structured system. whose geometry, kinematics, and dynamics can be used for comparison with the natural prototype. We don't want to really to realize a model which is specifically explaining one situation, one structure. What we want to understand a little bit better the physics behind the process. Is analog modeling is new, not a new methodology, not at all. This is Kaldel that was using one of the first sandbox. But after that time, we are creating increasingly complex models thanks to the inclusion of high-resolution monitoring technique and the use of new analog materials. And let me say that analog modeling is still one good inspiring methodology that can be used to interpret in a dynamic way the natural data. If we want to consider the kind of analog models that have been realized in our community to study the earthquakes, we can distinguish these models in three large categories. The spring slider models, so models where elastic and frictional elements are physically discrete parts of the setup. These kind of models are used mainly for earthquake prediction and can be only conceptually applied to nature. We can include another category, the fault block models, in which the elastic blocks with similar or different elastic properties are in frictional contact. And we can qualitatively extrapolate the results to the natural prototype. And finally, we have scale models in which the tonic settings are realistically simulated with some boundary condition and some simplification, mimicking the natural prototype. And this kind of models can be quantitatively upscaled to the natural case. Well, at the laboratory experimental tectonics, we were tempting after years working with the subduction to design a new apparatus able to simulate the seismicity of the subduction thrust fault. And for this purpose, years ago, we started from selecting a new analog material. Then we learned to use the rheometer, and we explored the rheologic behavior of a wide range of materials, arriving to the conclusion that a certain kind of gelatin, what is called pig skin, with a certain condition of temperature and composition, can reasonably scaling the lithospheric behavior. Afterwards, the next step was to scale down the frictional behavior of the analog faults. Then what we did was to use one spring block-like model, and we explore the rule of loading rate, normal pressure, and the interface roughness on the frictional dynamics, and arriving to the conclusion that the sandpaper with a certain kind of grade could simulate quite properly in its interface with the gelatin, the subduction thrust fault. And then we assembled everything together in what is called the gelquake machine, which was really a new analog setting able to simulate the subduction zone seismicity, featuring realistic tectonic loading, rate-dependent friction at the plate interface, and viscoelastic stress relaxation of the lithosphere. But let's see a little bit in detail the machine. So we have a wedge of gelatin, which is confined laterally by a plexiglass wall, and below by a rigid base plate, the analog of the subducting plate, which is moved downward by the stepping motor. The interface between the subducting plate, the rigid base plate, and the gel is nothing else than the subduction thrust fault, on the surface of which we have a patch of sandpaper, which is our seismogenic part of the subduction thrust fault. And we acquired the experiment continuously with two cameras from the top and the lateral view. And I will show you afterwards what's happening during the model. In particular, the model is preliminary seeded with some passive tracers that can be excited with a UV light along the center line of the system. So we can see what's going on inside the model during the evolution of the model itself. And this is what's going on during the experiment. The subducting plate is moving downward, and you see after a little bit of time from the beginning that analog earthquakes are spontaneously nucleating as a result of the stress buildup and plate interface strength. And what we are able to do is using some image analysis technique is to obtain the velocity field of what is going on inside the model and on the surface. And from this information, we can, for instance, extract the velocity time series. You see here the horizontal velocity of the particles along a section which is parallel on as respect to the subduction thrust fault. It's evolving in time. And you see here that there are alternate phases of quiescence with phases of high speed, marked here by these green dots, that are the same of the interseismic stage and the analog earthquakes, respectively. So we can really have a lot of microquakes and associated seismic cycles. And from our images, we can also extract information on the spatiotemporal slip rate evolution. You see here, we can obtain the hypocenter, the earthquake duration, and the rupture width. And at the end, for each of our experiments, we can have the slip distribution as happening on the subduction megathrust. You see here 50 events of one of our experiments, and for each of the events happening here, we have the hypocenter position, the rupture limit, and the slip distribution. And looking at this data, you can see that we can capture events of various sizes, that the majority of the events are nucleating inside the velocity weakening zone, here marked by these two dotted lines, and propagate afterwards in the velocity strengthening one. We see here that usually the events are nucleating in the deeper part of the rupture and propagate preferentially seaward. And that finally, there is a proportionality between the slip and the rupture as it's happening in nature. What is also very interesting, especially as respect to what we saw yesterday at the beginning of the workshop, is that our models are able to catch the velocity field on the surface, something that can be afterwards compared with the data we obtained from GPS or other kind of shallow analysis. You see here one of our experiments, the top view of one of our experiments during the interseismic stage. And you see here that the velocity field is showing all the arrows pointing out landward. As we can see in subduction zones where large earthquakes occurred long ago, like Chile, for instance. While during the ecoseismic stage, you see here that the velocity field is suddenly pointing out the trench. So, but it's more. We can look inside the model along the center line, and we can observe co-seismic vertical displacement. You see here areas in subsidence, so with uplift during the co-seismic stage, which is something that we can observe a few kilometers from the trench and the inland sites during the occurrence of large events. And we can have information about the velocity field inside the model and the slip distribution, something that, again, can be compared with natural observables. So I hope that I really convinced you that this method is capable of reproducing tens of seismic cycles in a convenient time and with an accurate enough resolution. And that I convinced you that this one is really, it's not a precise, but it's an inspiring methodology to interpret afterwards the geological and the seismological data, something which is absolutely mandatory. Otherwise, only with the models, we cannot do anything. And I want to remind you that the LAT is not really the only lab in which it's possible to do this kind of models. In Europe, there are also two other wonderful labs in Potsdam and in Montpellier, where with different apparati and different materials, very nice experiments on the subduction thrust faults are realized. And what is really good is that these three labs, the LAT, Potsdam, and Montpellier, but not only analog labs, are included under the EPOS umbrella. What is EPOS? EPOS is a project led by Massimo Cocco and supported by the European Commission, which is trying to realize the open access of data and infrastructures. And in this frame, the laboratory community is organizing different services, and in particular, what is called TNA, transnational access. So we are trying to open our labs to the researchers who are interested to work with us, supporting their traveling sometimes, but all the experimental fees. We just opened one new pilot call. So if you are interested to come to one of our labs, please go apply. Now it's only an in-kind test, but we hope that in the future we can really establish a long-term structure for this kind of activity. So after a little bit of advertisement, let's move to a selection of the results. So let's answer to some questions. The first one is, with our data, with our methodology, we were able to define, first of all, the geometry of the seismogenic zones. And for this purpose, we were merging our transects, our 505 transects, in 62 segments with homogeneous seismicity. And then we decide to describe the seismogenic zone as a structure of moderately sized earthquakes occurred in the past. And in this way, we were able to define the width of the seismogenic part of the subduction thrust fault, the up dip, the down dip limits, and the deep. And what we obtained was to confirm that the subduction thrust fault is a shallow structure with a large variability in width, and especially it's extremely variable, the horizontal projection of the up dip at the down dip limit. We found that, surprisingly, that 70% of our subduction zones are extending about 10 kilometers or more as respect to the Fourier arc MOHO that for a long time has been imagined and the down dip limit of the seismogenic part of the subduction thrust fault, suggesting that the extent of serpentinization of the mantle wedge may differ locally. Then what we did was to define the seismogenic zone activity in terms of different seismic parameters, the seismic moment rate, the moment release rate, the equivalent representative magnitude, the seismic coupling, and the maximum magnitude. And what we found is that it's indeed confirmed that this tectonic framework is able to trigger the largest events, having the mean value for the moment release rate and the maximum magnitude, respectively, at 8.2 and 7.8. We found in particular that 75% of the subduction zones experienced at least a 7.5 event. And what was interesting is that the seismic coupling we found it's extremely low, suggesting that the slip is mostly aseismic or that the strain is accumulating during the analyzing time. Then it was tempting for us to try to understand if there was any relationship between the subduction thrust fault parameters and the parameters characterizing the subduction itself. And we tried at the beginning different linear combinations, both using the Pearson correlation coefficient of the Spearman 1. And the reaction was always like this. That, I mean, was not really surprising because the subduction zone is really a complex environment and the single parameter is never able to explain the whole complexity observed at the subduction interfaces. So for sure we need the multi-parametric analysis, something that we recently are doing, and I will show you the results. But at that time, we found that the subduction velocity was really one of the best tunable factor for the subduction seismicity. And in particular, we found, looking at the data, that the fast and, in turn, cold subduction zone was producing a large number of moderate earthquakes over a narrow, deep, and steeply dipping seismogenic interface. Physically due to the combination between stress accumulation and temperature-related processes. But what was extremely important was the control of the velocity of subduction on the seismic rate, something that, thanks to our models, we confirmed. In fact, we found this good linear relationship here marked by the blue dots, between tau and the velocity of subduction, confirmed also by numerical models realized in Zurich by the Ilona van Dinter group. But it's true that the velocity of subduction is absolutely unable to explain the maximum magnitude experienced at subduction zone. So it's tempting to try to answer to another question, which are the conditions for mega earthquakes genesis? So, A long time ago, with Serge Arnoux, we were looking at the data, and what was surprising was to find that the maximum magnitude recorded in the seismic catalogs were happening along subduction zones characterized by a natural UPS, a natural upper plate strain. So it was really surprising because in our mind, the largest compressive stresses were reflecting the presence of the largest asperities. But then, we come out with the idea that it's true, what I told you before is true, but it's also true that large compressive stresses can inhibit the lateral propagation of the rupture. So we end up with proposing what we call the UPS regime model, in which the natural regime was really the favorable interplay between a significant large initial released seismic moment and the low critical stress allowing for lateral rupture propagation. Recently we tried also to realize some more complex statistical analysis on the database. In particular, we are adopting what is called pattern recognition analysis. I don't want to enter in these details that are boring. We can talk about them afterwards if you want. But essentially, we are using these classification techniques, thanks to which we can recognize if there is a recurrent pattern occurring between parameters belonging to different fields that are classified in classes. What we are doing is to look at the old parameters, characterize the different subduction zones, and looking if they are divided as respect to the maximum magnitude that has been recorded along this subduction thrust fault. We found that the combination between sediment thickness, trench parallel length, and UPS could be the element controlling the mega earthquake generation. In particular, the rule of sediments is not something new. Different authors in the past proposed that the sediments can smoothen the seafloor or weaken the subduction interface. In both cases, this is enhancing the lateral rupture propagation. What we did was to try to plot UPS, the maximum magnitude of subduction zones with respect to UPS and the sediment thickness of the trench. And as you can see here, there is a quite good correlation between the subduction zones that experienced large earthquakes with the presence of large sediment thickness of the trench and the natural UPS. And finally, what we tried also to do was to see if there is any favorable mechanism able to enhance the domino effect rupturing the different asperities, so enhancing the lateral rupture propagation after the occurrence of an earthquake. And for this purpose, we were changing our experimental settings, putting discrete patches of sandpaper, the analog of Asperides, and using one velocity strengthening material, the analog of barriers, and in a parametric way, changing systematically the dimension of barriers and Asperides. And what is very nice is that the rupture is happening in very different way. So sometimes the earthquake is occurring inside one Asperity and it's arresting inside within the Asperity. Or you can rupture the entire Asperity, or you can jump towards the barrier and rupture the entire length of the model. So what yesterday Marianne started with this sentence, mapping coupling is not really sufficient to anticipate the rupture dynamic. You need to reconstruct the segment history and the frictional parameter. And I was really happy to see at this sentence. And we found that the maximum magnitude is inversely correlated with this dimensionless parameter, dB over dA, that is the dimension of the barrier over the dimension of the Asperity, and also the percentage of synchronized rupture, showing that there is a sort of threshold at 0.5 marking synchronized and non-synchronized Asperities. To conclude, really, in 30 seconds, I would like to come back here in the future and to answer also to this question. Maybe it's a dream. What for sure we can do is to, for the database, is to update continuously it, to improve it. There are Serge Lallemand and Eleonora Van Riesinger who are, for instance, adding information about the seafloor roughness at different wavelengths. With Claudia Piromallo and Arnoux Auré, we are working since a while in order to have the different seismicity, not only the interplate seismicity, but also what is occurring inside the slab and on the overriding plate. We are continuously working in finding new analog materials, something that can improve similarities to nature. Recently, we added salt to the gelatin and was much better, but we would like to have the entire seismicity plotted and also moving to larger apparatus. Everything is in progress. We indeed want also every time to compare the data with numerical ones, and now after me, new and very nice numerical models will be presented. The dream is at the end to have a global model, so something that in the future can be in 3D, dynamically self-consistent, in which we can resemble together everything happening at surface at that depth. For sure it's a dream, but I mean, if we can dream it, we can probably do it, especially if we are working together. And let's talk like this.